Welcome to the Continuing Education Podcast for CASA Volunteers, connecting you with experts who can advance your advocacy for children and families. I'm your host, Maggie Halpin, and this is CASA On The Go.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode, and I am so thrilled to have with us today Sarah Bryant, the Managing Attorney for the Family Helpline at the Texas Legal Services Center. And I'm really excited for this conversation, for us to get to hear not only about the amazing work that y'all are doing at the Family Helpline, but how we can learn from that work and from what you've learned from the families that you're supporting. So Sarah, I'd love to kick it off by inviting you to share a little bit about your background and what brought you to this work. I remember you mentioned that in your previous work, you represented children and you represented parents involved in CPS cases. And that experience really revolutionized your thinking about the CPS process. So I would just love to hear a little bit about your background before we dive into the work that y'all are doing at the Family Helpline.
Sure. So thanks so much, Maggie. I'm really happy to be with you here today and talk more about our program and what we do. So like you said, I am currently the managing attorney at the Family Helpline at Texas Legal Services Center, and we are a free statewide hotline that provides legal information about the child welfare system in Texas, and I will talk more about that in a bit, but a little bit about my background. So I've worked in child welfare law for about 10 years now.
Oh, wow.
In college, I really had no interest at all in being a lawyer. But after college, I was running a program for women and children who were transitioning out of homelessness. And one issue that kept coming up was criminal records that some of these women unfortunately had, which was really limiting their options for housing and work and just stability. So that was really the first spark where I started seeing how our legal systems can really have potentially long-term negative effects on families, particularly low-income families. So after that, I kind of decided to like dip my toe in the legal waters, and I was a paralegal at a criminal defense law firm for a couple of years, and I got to know a lot of criminal defendants really personally, and I was able to see them as people, right, with families and loved ones and people who are often scared, and they were just in this incredibly vulnerable situation, and our firm did this really cool thing, which has always stuck with me, where we would make something called a good guy file for each of our clients, and we would get letters from their friends and family. We would hear about all their great attributes and what people loved about them. We would keep track of their volunteer work and just steps that they'd kind of taken on their own to address whatever the issue or the mistake was that brought them into the criminal justice system in the first place. And I got to tell you, it was really amazing how you could read the police report and affidavit from the arrest, and then you could read their good guy file. Be like, how is this the same person that we're even talking about? So I think that really stuck with me, just this concept that one action or one affidavit shouldn't define a person. And also this idea that I think the legal system often doesn't see people in their full personhood, in their full context. And that's where strong advocacy by an attorney or by some other advocate can really come into play. So those experiences are what ultimately led me to law school. And I knew I wanted to do something poverty law related, but I wasn't totally sure what. But at UT Law, there is a clinic that some of the CASAs who work in Travis County might be familiar with called the Children's Rights Clinic. And that's where law students represent children as their attorney ad litem. And I did that clinic and I was hooked, and I've been doing child welfare work ever since. So a couple of the roles that I've had since then, I've worked at the Texas Foster Youth Justice Project, which is at Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid. I was representing current and former foster youth. So I really got to see the end of the line, right? These kids who had aged out of foster care and all of the struggles that they were facing. And then I moved a bit more upstream, and I represented parents and children in TMC cases. And then I wanted to kind of move even more upstream, and that's really what brought me to the Family Helpline, where I've been for the past 5 years now, and I've been managing attorney for 2 years. So my role now is really just to educate people and the general public about child welfare law and policy, what their rights are, how the system works. You know, I feel very strongly that people should be able to make informed decisions, particularly when it comes to their families and child safety. I really think knowledge is power. And my goal with every call is just to empower people to make the best decision for their own unique situation.
Wow, Sarah, thank you so much for that. Like, there's so much I want to respond to that you were saying, but you said it all so eloquently, especially that just kind of reminder about how the legal system often really eclipses whole people and doesn't often treat people as whole human beings, but focuses on often maybe someone, the worst day of someone's life, and kind of defines them by that. And so I think that's such, that's just a, like a really helpful reminder for CASAs, for us who are working with people who are families who are in the CPS system, to always be looking for people's strengths, to always be, like one question that I really love, that's like a question we can be asking parents when we're first getting to know them is, you know, we don't know each other yet, but like, when I do get to know you, what's something that I'll really admire about you as a parent? Like, let's start off the conversation, the relationship, with the parents and families that we work with, by, you know, opening the door and focusing on strengths. So, thank you. Yeah. Thanks for that reminder. And it's just so cool to hear about, all the work you've done so far in your career and kind of all the ways that you've been, supporting youth and their families. Could you talk a little bit about what the Family Helpline does and how this really awesome legal aid resource came to be?
Sure. So, like I mentioned, we are a project at Texas Legal Services Center. We're funded by the Texas Supreme Court Children's Commission and the Texas Access to Justice Foundation. And the Family Helpline was created due to several factors, but a big part was this recognition that child protective investigations and family preservation, or FBSS, cases touch so many more families in Texas every year than those families whose children are removed and who end up in court, right? So because a parent's right to a free court-appointed attorney isn't triggered until the department files a petition either for removal or now for court-ordered services, the vast majority of the families in these earlier stages don't have access to legal representation or counsel. And most of these families can't afford to just go out and hire an attorney. And they're totally lost, and they're often being asked to make very important and possibly long-term decisions about children and about their families without being able to talk to an attorney. And to really understand what their options are and what the long-term implications of their decisions might be. So just to give you an idea of how many more families might be involved in these earlier stages, I was looking at the DFPS data book, which is on the DFPS website, from 2022. And looking at the number of investigations that happened that year, that number was 166,000 investigations. And of those, only 5,000 were referred for removal, and only about 9,000 were referred for family preservation out of 166,000. So I'm not sure how many of those 9,000 ultimately received an attorney because a court-ordered services petition was filed, but anyone who was referred to family preservation where no petition was filed would not be entitled to an attorney. So that's about over 90% of these families that are making contact with the child welfare system without access to a free attorney. And then to put it more in terms of people, because obviously every investigation is going to involve probably multiple adults and multiple children, the data book lists the number of clients who are part of investigations in 2022 as 976,000. So that's almost a million Texans.
Wow.
416,000 of those are children. So again, compare that to only the 9,000 that were removed. That's just a huge justice gap. and it's potentially affecting hundreds of thousands of children in Texas each year. And so the helpline was really created to fill that gap. But even though a big chunk of our calls are involved in these more upstream issues, we're not just limited to that. We can talk to people in any stage of CPS involvement. We can even talk to people who are trying to prevent child abuse and neglect, so even more upstream. We can talk to people who have had closed CPS cases. That's actually a very common question that we get. These people are just trying to make sense of what happened, or perhaps several years have passed since the case ended and the family's situation has significantly changed and they're just wondering what their options are. We also get a good amount of questions about general child safety, which typically takes place in general family law courts. So for example, how to get a protective order, how to modify conservatorship orders so that they're more protective, questions about temporary restraining orders and enforcements, and just general family law related to child safety. So in all of these situations, again, we really believe that people should be making informed, educated decisions. We just find that so many of these people are making decisions out of fear and out of misinformation. And I don't think that that's really in any child's best interest, right? So the way our program works is we have a helpline number. It's 844-888-6565. We are open between 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. And we have experienced child welfare attorneys who are available to answer live calls and to talk to absolutely anyone who has questions about the child welfare system in Texas. So we really are just open to anybody, as long as their questions pertain to the legal system involving CPS or child safety. Most of our callers are parents, but callers don't have to be. About at least a quarter, sometimes up to a third of our callers are relatives. So we have a lot of questions from relatives. We have a smaller number of callers who are unrelated to the child. So that might be community members or teachers or social workers or family friends. I think one really, really unique and cool aspect of our program is that our calls are all anonymous. So we just go by first name and people can use whatever name they want. We just take a name in case they need to call us back. And we have found that that really allows people to speak a lot more openly and honestly about their cases. Yes. There's just not very many safe places where people can talk about these things without fear of being reported or without fear of it getting back to their caseworker, right? So we can provide that safe space. It is completely free. We don't have any income limitations. Unlike most legal service programs, you know, a lot of them have caps on the income that someone can have to receive service. We don't have that. We do serve the entire state of Texas. So that's another really unique piece of our program. And we can even talk to people who live outside Texas as long as their question is about Texas law. One other really important thing to note, and I try to be very clear about this, is that we provide legal information only. So we can't provide legal representation. We're not going to court for people. We're not telling people what to do, right? We're simply laying out their options and educating them on the relevant law or policy. And because we can't provide those further legal services, there are a lot of callers we get who certainly need that. And so in those cases, we try our hardest to refer them to the appropriate programs whenever we can. What might be available to them is really going to depend on where in Texas their case is, what their income is, what stage of CPS involvement they're in. And there's unfortunately not resources for everybody. But we work really, really hard to stay on top of all the programs that are out there. And we collaborate quite a bit with all the other child welfare groups across the state. And so we're, I think, really on top of knowing who to send people to when we can. And then if we talk to a person who's really their only option is to represent themselves, we'll talk them through self-help resources, particularly those on TexasLawHelp.org, which is a website that's also a project of Texas Legal Services Center. And when we recognize gaps in the legal information that's on that website, we create content to fill those gaps. So, for example, We've created toolkits for relatives who might want to intervene in a CPS case. We've created toolkits for requesting a temporary restraining order to protect a child in an emergency. And there's a lot more on there. So that's a gist of what we do. I also just want to say I'm really proud of the team of attorneys that we have. All of them have been working in child welfare law for years, and they have such a passion for the work. They really know their stuff. They're all trauma trained. And beyond that, they're just really nice people. And I think that they're really easy to talk to.
Oh, that is, it's so cool to hear that this exists, that this team of kind, informed, you know, trauma trained attorneys is there to answer people's questions and kind of like you were describing, like try to help catch the people, the families who are falling through these cracks in the legal support that is made available by our system. I feel like that's something that CASA especially can really appreciate, since like CASA itself was created, you know, when a judge decades back said there's a gap that needs to be filled, and that's where CASA was founded. And so to see that y'all are trying to stand in that justice gap, I think was the word that you used, which was really beautiful, make sure that people do have access to the information that they need and deserve. I just feel so strongly along with you that people need and deserve to be in the loop and not in the dark when it comes to their own families, their own futures. And I think as CASA's too, like facilitating open communication with families that we're working with is a really big part of our role, and trying to make sure that people do have access to information. Of course, being sensitive to confidentiality is huge, and we can't always share every information. We can't always share information about everything, but we can, you know, direct people back to the caseworker if we're not able to disclose something. But it's so critical that family members have access to the information and support needed to successfully navigate our complex and overwhelming child welfare system. I was thinking about how when we train a new CASA volunteer, we get an extensive 30-hour training on how the legal system works. And trying to imagine myself being a parent who's, you know, going through the traumatic experience of becoming involved with CPS, and you don't get any kind of like orientation like that. So drawing on the conversations that you have with folks who reach out to the helpline, what would you say are the information gaps around the CPS legal process that y'all are seeing families encountering?
Certainly. So lack of access to information and just understanding what's going on in a CPS case is extremely common, both for parents and relatives. I think for parents, you know, a good parent's attorney will explain these things to them at the beginning of the case and hopefully throughout the case. But not all attorneys do that, unfortunately. And even the ones who do, sometimes it doesn't always sink in, you know, especially like you said, if the parent's really suffering from trauma, if they're just overwhelmed, which why wouldn't they be? If maybe there's some mental health or intellectual disability or some other factor at play. So specifically for anyone involved in a TMC case, they may not understand basic things like the timeline of the case, the importance of services, what steps they can take to increase visitation with their child, the possible outcomes of the case, and what the purpose of each hearing is. So often just getting the lay of the land, I think, helps people feel more engaged and empowered. They're not so confused. They don't feel like they're just floundering and spinning their wheels, which unfortunately I think a lot of parents in these cases do. And it also, I think, helps them stay focused on the issue at hand. So, you know, if a parent has an attorney, you could remind them that their attorney is required to meet with them by law before each court hearing, and to abide by that parent's objectives for representation. And how can an attorney do that? How can they abide by their client's objectives if they're not explaining their options and getting their input, right? So these are conversations that need to take place, but I don't know that the parent always knows to ask for that or that they're entitled to that. And also, you know, if someone you know needs some extra hand-holding, some extra understanding, you could always refer them to the family helpline. As far as relatives go, yes, we frequently get calls from relatives who are concerned about the children and their family. They're wanting to make sure they're being cared for. They're asking what happened, why are the parents involved, where are the children living? And we at the family helpline don't have that information, right? We're not affiliated with CPS in any way. And I understand that CASA is also not in a place to share that information. So that can feel really frustrating. But I do think there can be advocacy by CASAs around just getting these relatives pulled into the case. Most of the time, they just need a foothold. They just need a way to be noticed. They just need someone to acknowledge them, right? Yeah. We talk to a lot of relatives who say, I've called everyone. I've called the caseworker. I've called the ad litem. I've called the CASA. No one will talk to me. And I am not really sure why that is. You know, I find it very surprising, especially when the relative I'm talking to in that moment feels like they have really good information about the child's history, or they had maybe in the past or more recently a really close relationship with the child, and they could provide some support to that child either as a placement or in a million other ways, right? So I think that's something a CASA could do that would be really helpful. Talk to the relative, gather information, and then you could do like a warm handoff almost to the caseworker or whoever else you think would benefit. Just introduce them and just explain who they are, what they could bring to the case. You know, caseworkers are super busy and there's a fair amount of turnover. So I don't think that they can give relatives the same amount of time and attention that CASAs can. And that's a really unique and special thing about being a CASA. And I also think a really effective CASA worker is one who is able to build rapport with everyone on the case. They really know their case. They really know their family. And the other attorneys and advocates will respect that. And so if the CASA stands up and says, we really need to talk to this grandma, or, you know, this uncle has some really great information, then hopefully the other people will listen. And I think the relatives who are feeling very cut out would be very grateful just to be listened to, and just, again, to have someone acknowledge that in a way they're suffering too, because they're related to this child who is now in the conservatorship of the state and they have very little information about what's going on. And of course, if they ever have legal questions, another plug, but you can refer them to the family helpline to talk to an attorney, and you can remind them, you know, we can't represent them, unfortunately, but we can answer questions about what they can expect throughout the process.
Yeah. It hurts my heart to hear about those conversations with relatives that, you know, you're hearing from who are feeling so cut out of what's unfolding for their own family, maybe, or a child in their community that they really care about and feel like they can't, they're not being let in to the process. And I totally agree that that's a place where a CASA volunteer can make a huge impact, that we can really be working so hard to bring people to the table and to be like working to make those connections with people. Like, we want to help make sure that people their voices are heard. So I think that's something maybe for folks who are listening to just maybe take a moment to reflect on that. Is there more we could be doing, you know, with every child, with every family that we're working with right now, to make sure that we're reaching out to people, we're listening to people, we're following up with the folks who are out there and who care. And so you kind of are already addressing this, Sarah, but just kind of considering the themes and the trends that y'all see and the kinds of questions and concerns that family members bring to the helpline, are there other thoughts that you have about how CASAs and others on the case could work to better communicate with and engage with families?
I mean, I think the biggest thing is just returning phone calls, right? Again, it's just a very common thing, and it's not necessarily just CASAs, but maybe their attorneys have only talked to them once the whole case, or maybe their caseworkers have only met with them a handful of times. And I can't even begin to comprehend how frustrating and disempowering that would feel if it was involving my children, you know? I think another practical thing that we run into at the helpline quite a bit is just reminding parents and relatives that a big piece of communication in this day and age is having their phone set up, you know, having their voicemail working, making sure it's not full of messages. If they have an email, are they checking it every day? If they're having trouble keeping their phone on, could there be some resources in the community that might be able to help with that? Because communication is so key in these cases. And once the parents kind of fall out of communication, it can be very, very difficult to get the case back on track sometimes. I also think just being kind and just engage with everyone, introducing yourself, remembering that it might take multiple times for it really to sink in with the family, exactly who you are and what your role is. There's so many strangers on these cases, and it's very overwhelming for the families to keep track of. You can consistently ask them, do you have any questions? And if you can't answer them, tell them who can. Help them navigate that, because you know better the role of each player than they probably do. As far as relatives go, I feel like we've already talked about this quite a lot, but just talking to everyone. Every relative, I think, is a piece of the puzzle of this child's life, and you will learn something, even if you get nothing else out of it. I think we can be more creative and thinking about relatives as supports in ways other than just placement. Something I hear on the phone quite a bit, at least from relatives' perspectives, can't speak to the whole story, but from their perspective, they feel like once the department has met its duty to place a child with a relative, that communication with other relatives is just kind of shut down by all the other child advocates. And so, yeah, my question is just like, what if that placement falls apart? You know, don't you want a backup? What about just supporting the placement? What if they need a babysitter so they can get a break? What about helping them with transportation or supervision of visits? You know, what about just showing up to court just to show that this family is strong and that the child is not alone? You could go to school events. You could go to graduation. You could go to athletic games. Like, these are all ways to make the child feel really loved. It's not just about placement. Another thing is, thinking critically about placement in ways, in the sense that you get to form your own idea of what you think is in the child's best interest, right? You don't have to just stand by what the other parties think. That's the role of the CASA. And so even if CPS, for example, can't approve a placement, maybe because their policy doesn't allow them to, that doesn't mean that it can't be advocated for. What if a relative would be a great fit, but their house just needs some repairs? That's easy. You know, reach out to your local churches or your local housing initiatives and think about how such a small action could really reduce trauma to a child who would love to be with family in a home that feels comfortable instead of potentially in foster care. I think lastly, just think long term. I think we don't spend enough time thinking about what happens when we're out of this family's life. Like I said, a really big portion of calls to the helpline are from families who are 1, 2, 5, 10 years past when the CPS case is over. And that has really given me a new perspective on how what we do in TMC cases is setting up this family for either failure or success. And we need to ask, are we really being honest with ourselves about that for every single child? Are our goals for permanency really going to support that child until they turn 18? Or are we just kind of scrambling for permanency because we have this legal deadline looming over our heads?
Yeah. Wow. So many great points. Thank you, Sarah. And I feel like they all connect to one another so powerfully too, that I feel like you're so right about sometimes I have seen that where it's like the focus is so much on placement and there's almost like blinders on around like, but what about the value of connectedness for that child and for that parent or those parents, for that caregiver? Like, what about like really focusing not only on the placement, but on cultivating this connectedness and long term, so that once we're out of this family's life, there is, you know, we've helped to strengthen the support system that is already there. So I feel like, yeah, that so many great points for us to reflect on. And especially right now, you know, I was just thinking with all of the change that's happening in our system around the state, we've got new players coming in and different, you know, single source continuum contractors that are stepping into the case management role in different parts of the state. And there's just a lot of moving pieces for everyone. And it's so important that we are so committed to making sure no parent, no family member is left behind in the dust, you know, with all these changes that are happening and just how quickly the system can move sometimes. And I, when you were speaking, I just remembered like when I was working with families, like sometimes showing up at a family meeting and having this terrible realization, like no one put in the work to let family members know like that the meeting was happening and, that everyone was just like too overwhelmed. Right. And just, I feel so much grief now when I think about a meeting like that, you know, and, that those are really such incredible opportunities to bring the support system together for that family, to facilitate those like important conversations about like, you know, what do y'all need to move forward and how can you, you know, how can these folks in your life, you know, provide that support for you, mom or dad, you know? Right. So yeah, really, really great things to be thinking about. And I know we're almost out of time, Sarah, but, just lastly, like, you know, at CASA, we really believe that all children and families deserve access to justice. And something that you mentioned when we spoke before was the critical importance of procedural justice. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what that means and how child advocates can bring this idea into our work with families.
Sure. So this idea of procedural justice is something I was first introduced to when I worked in criminal defense. And it's something that's really integral to the Family Helplines model. And I personally find it really powerful. So the procedural justice idea, it involves this idea of a fair processes and how a person's perception of whether they were treated fairly and with dignity is the strongest indicator of whether they had a good or bad experience. So we might think that the outcome of a person's case, so for example, whether a child came home would be the strongest indicator about whether someone feels they were treated fairly, but it's really not. According to the Justice Collaboratory at Yale Law School, they have a really great website on procedural justice, and they say that an individual's perceptions of a procedurally just encounter with the law is based on four features, and those features are, number one, whether they were treated with dignity and respect. Number two, whether they were given a voice. Number three, whether the decision maker was neutral and transparent. And number four, whether the decision maker conveyed trustworthy motives. So I think in my head, I picture two different moms who've had their children removed. And one mom throughout the process is being treated with dignity. She's having her voice heard. Her attorney is meeting with her regularly and explaining all of her options and advocating strongly for her. Her judge is clearly explaining what's going to happen according to the law and what her rights are. The caseworker and the CASA are speaking with her respectfully, keeping her properly informed about what's going on with her kids. In this situation, she's really being given a fair shot and the support that she needs. But ultimately, if she can't do that, let's just imagine she agrees to relinquish her rights and her rights are ultimately terminated. Even though there's no doubt that she'll be sad about that outcome, I'd like to think in her heart she would know that she was given a fair shot and that her children needed that permanency. And then compare that to a mom who was brought into the system through a botched investigation where policy was not followed, where her rights were not respected, where the facts in her removal affidavit were just completely incorrect. Her attorney never talked to her. Her judge just kind of seemed to have it out for her from the beginning. The caseworker and the CASA are speaking to her in this really rude, disdainful way, and she's feeling like she's being verbally attacked in every interaction with them. But she works her services and gets her kids back. I mean, which of these two moms do you think would say they had a better experience and that was they were treated fairly? It's not going to be the mom who was successfully reunited, right? Even though she was successful in the legal sense, she's probably going to be suffering with trauma and anxiety surrounding that experience for the rest of her life. And she is never going to trust the child welfare system again. But again, the mom whose rights were terminated is probably much more at peace and feels like justice was done because she was treated with dignity and the process was transparent and trustworthy. I love that. I really believe that procedural justice is key to ensuring that children and families are provided access to a fair child welfare system that both protects the physical safety and the well-being of the child, but also honors the rule of law and parents' rights and the protections that are intentionally laid out in our law. And I also think it's so important because a family who feels that they've been treated fairly is going to be more likely to respect the outcome of the case. Their trauma will be reduced. And I also think as a community, we can just work towards improving the public's perception of the child welfare system as a fair system, right? Mm. So I just really love to remind myself of those four factors from time to time and just think about how I'm applying that on each phone call I have. I really believe the Family Helpline promotes dignity and respect by explaining all of the options and believing that they are in the best place to make that decision for themselves. I think we promote dignity by the way that we talk to people. We give them space to tell their story. We listen attentively. I can't say that word today. I think that also goes towards letting them have a voice. As far as neutral and trustworthy decision-making goes, the way I see that with the Family Helpline is we are explaining the rules of the system. And callers hopefully will gain trust that each role player is just simply doing their job, right? Even if the parent doesn't necessarily agree with their position, it's just going to help them understand the motives of each player and the laws that are at play and the policies that CPS has to follow. So, you know, as a CASA, I think you could also think about what you could do to promote procedural justice. Are you treating families with dignity, right? Even if you're unhappy with their decisions, which you probably are you listening to them? Are you really, really listening? There's so much more context to these stories. I hear it every day on the phone. Can you really clearly explain what your role is? I think that's an important, just basic thing to be able to do. Do you stick to your word? Do you do what you say you're going to do? One thing I think is really important is, do you take the time to explain why you're making your recommendations to the court? So that even if someone doesn't necessarily agree, at least they understand your thought process and your motives, and they can glean something from that. And also, are you constantly checking your biases? Are you pushing back on stereotypes? Are you making sure that certain families aren't treated differently than others just because of their culture or some other factor? I really love this procedural justice framework, and I think it's a great lens to make sure that we're promoting a fair child welfare system.
Yeah, that is a wonderful framework, and thank you so much for sharing that with us. Sarah, I've just learned so much from hearing you speak, and I'm so grateful for your time and truly for the work that y'all are doing, providing this amazing resource for families. So thank you so much. Thank you. Thanks so much for tuning in to CASA on the Go. We'll be on hiatus for the month of July, and we'll return with a new episode in August. Stay cool, everyone.